Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of All Brother, a podcast about legendary musical institution, The Fall. Each week we invite along a guest to chat about their experiences and memories of the group. You can find us at all the usual suspects, but we're hosted at play.acast.com/s/Old Brother. All episodes are also available on YouTube. Search for Old Brother Podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. This week we're joined by actor, producer, writer and part-time Death Eater, Mr. Graham Duff, who will tell us about his experiences of The Fall and his collaborations with Mark E. Smith. Hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Old Brother, a Fall podcast, hosted by me, Paul Hanley, and my excellent brother Stephen, who was a member of The Fall for 20 years, well, give or take. I think he played bass. Joining us this week is scriptwriter, director, producer, script editor and author. It was getting a bit crowded in here. Mr. Graham Duff, as you probably know if you're a Fall fan, and if you're not a Fall fan, I'm not quite sure why you're listening to this, but there you go. He recently published The Otherwise, which was as yet unfilmed.
Yes.
Is it horror? Is it sci-fi?
It's horror thriller, I suppose. Yeah, it's a horror thriller. It's a horror and it's thrilling. Yeah, a few people said it's folk horror, but there's some of that in it, but it sort of engages with technology a bit as well. So it's not your normal folk horror, if there's such a thing.
I didn't know there was a thing.
Well, there's a field in England, isn't there? That's a folk horror, isn't it?
Yeah. And Wicker Man and Midsommar, they all sort of do that thing where it's about, you know, ancient evil within the countryside and those sort of ideas, I suppose. And there is a bit of that in The Otherwise, for sure, yeah.
Right, well, we'll get on to that. We'll have to go back. I'm going back a bit further first.
Okay.
So I was reading your book, The 15 Gigs.
All right, yeah.
And I was reading, obviously, zoomed in on the Fall bit, and the first time you saw The Fall,
yeah.
I thought for years that was the first time I saw The Fall as well. It turned out that I'd actually seen them support the Rosillos at the Apollo slightly earlier, but that was Kelly's, 1978.
Yes.
That was your first time. Because we're pretty much the same age, I think.
Yeah, well, because I was 14 in 1978. So, yeah, we are the same age, aren't we? Yeah, so.
Indeed.
Yeah, no, I.
That was a great gig, that.
It was. I mean, when I saw that, I'd probably by that stage seen about five or six gigs, and I'd seen some good bands. You know, I'd seen The Clash, Suicide, Rosillo, Susie and the Banshees, but that gig was just, you know, they'd been on big proper stages in proper venues and that. I mean, Kelly's was tiny. There wasn't even a stage, was there?
Apparently, I was reading about that. Apparently, there should have been a stage, but they hadn't delivered it in time. And then, because it was Rock Against Racism.
Yes, yeah.
Who put it on. And the stage was due to be delivered, and it was that late for the next gig, which was Joy Division, Pete Hook had to drive and go and get it himself. So it was very glamorous, but that was great because they were right in your face, weren't they, then?
Yeah. I mean, I remember Mark just walking around the audience with the mic, sort of, you know, literally singing into people's faces. And I thought it was great because it was so, I don't know, because I was a school kid and I just liked disruption, I suppose. But it was really disruptive because I was so used to seeing, you know, that barrier between the audience and the musicians. I'd never seen that broken before, and it was broken. It was shattered, I suppose, really.
Yes, well, it was, because they were in your face in every sense of the word, the four, weren't they, I suppose. But that getting that close to Carl Burns was a bit of a thrill for me, because he was obviously, what a drummer he was. Yeah. But obviously, I knew Matt. Well, you were at that as well, Steve, I presume. I don't suppose I would have gone without you, would it?
Well, I'm assuming I was, yeah, but I don't really remember it. So Kelly's, it was in Manchester.
Yeah. Well, they only ever played Manchester and London then, the fall, as far as I can see, if you look at that gigography.
So where was Kelly's then?
It was near the bus station, I seem to remember.
Like Piccadilly?
Yeah.
Was it?
Somewhere over that way, yeah. I remember because I arrived there on the bus.
I'd have been shooed ill, mightn't it?
Oh, maybe. But I remember we walked for about, me and I went with this daft lad I was at school with, and we walked for about 45 minutes, found ourselves back really near the bus stop, and then found the gig. So we went on some ridiculous loop.
And this, walked to Electric Circus and back, did you?
Yeah. I went there via Russia and back again. It was quite weird, actually, because I was the only person I knew, as it were, who was into the Fall at that stage. I'd bought the Live at the Electric Circus compilation. Yeah. I'd bought Bingo Masters, and I couldn't convince anybody else. I suppose all my mates, you know, I didn't have that many mates who were into punk, but they were into much more, you know, straight ahead conventional punk, and they just didn't go for it. And then I remember saying to this lad Paul Barber, who somebody said, "Oh, he's really into music," and he was in my maths group. So I said to him, "I'm going to this Fall gig. Do you want to come?" He said, "Oh yeah, I love the Fall." I said, "Oh wow, that's amazing." Wow. And he was saying then his favourite band was Rainbow, and he really liked Status Quo. So I was thinking, oh, it's quite odd he likes the Fall. And then we were on the coach from Great Harwood, where I live, just outside Blackburn to Manchester. And I was sort of asking him about, because I was so into it, I was asking him about, you know, this lyric and what he thought about that. And it quickly became apparent he'd just been completely lying. He didn't know into the Fall, but he just wanted to look cool. And
the Fall.
I don't know, it seemed cool to me. But then I remember thinking at the time, of course he was lying, because I remember him having said at one point that his hi-fi was so good that when he played Nevermind the Bollocks, he could hear the band discussing what song to play next.
Brilliant.
Although, yes.
You should never. For that, did you?
No, not really.
Yeah. You can hear Sid asking where to put his finger to play an F.
Yes, exactly.
So that was the first time you saw the Fall, and then the next one I'm looking at here, you've got Manchester Poly 1982. Was that the all day thing?
No, I don't think so. No, it was. I think it was just in the evening. I saw them a few times in between. Then I saw them at Cone, Nelson and Cone, I think, at the Working Man's Club there. And I saw,
what year would that have been?
About, what would that be, 1980, I think, maybe?
Is that Working Men's Club or something in Nelson?
Yeah, it was a Working Men's Club in Nelson,
Club,
yeah.
Do you remember that,
Steve? It was the Railway Workers' Club, yes.
I tell you what, the glamour, unbelievable.
Oh, man, so true. Yeah.
You seem to play a lot of them kind of play. Wakefield we played as well. That was a Working Man's Club as well, wasn't it?
Was that just a desire to play as much as possible, so you'd sort of play anywhere? Was that the ethos?
I don't know, because nobody else seemed to.
I think whether it was by accident or by design, they did it quite cleverly. I think Mark and Kay, they kind of built up that following by just driving to gigs where he could go back to Manchester.
Yeah, right.
So they built up a following around the northwest. So, you know, they played sort of anywhere that was sort of an hour or so's drive from Manchester.
Because am I right in thinking you were doing at least one gig most weeks around about that time?
Yeah, we weren't. It wasn't touring as such. No. Like it became later. It was just like two gigs a week.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a way to get the band very tight, isn't it? I suppose, apart from anything else.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we ever did.
Never managed it.
I don't know, as an audience member, it always seemed really tightly drilled. I don't know. I mean, ragged, but tightly drilled.
Yeah, that's it. Well, that's the skill. That's the hard thing to get, that ragged but tight. It's not easy to do.
But if we all play at the same time.
We all play the wrong note at the same time, yeah. So who was in the band when they played Nelson then?
Mark Riley was already in the band.
Well, he was at Kelly's. He was on bass at Kelly's, yeah, wasn't he, Mark Riley?
I think he was on guitar by then because they were doing like New Face in Hell and stuff. So I think you would have been drumming.
If it was New Face in Hell, that would have been me.
Yeah.
I find it hard to believe that it doesn't loom in my memory more, Nelson Railway Club. You know, you think one of those places, isn't it? You know, like the super, you know, Madison Square Gardens or Hollywood Bowl. You know, you think. Yeah.
Why is that how bizarre? Yeah, no. Yes, because that was not long before after the Gram came out. I think that was like a couple of months before that, maybe. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so that'll have been 1980, won't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Right.
Yeah. And then the one at the Poly was supported by Virgin Prunes, and that's when there was you were doing the dual drummer lineup, and the Prunes came on. Like just in loincloths and sort of sat on the stage and painted each other. And it was weird because I remember thinking somehow it wasn't hippie. Yeah, I mean, they were phenomenal. You know, just like tape loops and these like amazing chords. And there were so many things about it that could have made it feel hippie-ish at the time. Because you know how hard lines so many sort of punks are. But somehow it didn't, did it? It was, you know, sitting in loincloths and painting each other.
Yeah. There was no air of well-being at all, was it? It wasn't like a loving, was it? It was terrifying. I seem to remember. Yeah. I mean, but that I've always said that. We've said it a couple of times on here. The contrast between them on stage and them in real life, because they were the nicest people in the world.
Yeah,
but on stage they were absolutely terrifying.
It was interesting, isn't it? Because it was properly grotesque, you know. And a lot of sort of punk bands at that time were pretending to be really in your face and that. But it was show business, and the Prunes and also the Fall were never show business, were they? It was always something a little bit more. Nope.
It's quite an amazing trick for them to pull off, them not being showbiz, considering how theatrical they were. It was easy for us not to be showbiz. Because we were just ambling on in our day clothes, but they managed to have that theatricality without looking like. Because they weren't like, it wasn't, I suppose it because it wasn't like a band, wasn't it? They weren't like pretending to be a band. They were like a theatrical act.
Yeah, and I suppose the other thing is it was working class, wasn't it? That's the other thing. It's not. That's. I mean, maybe some of them had a bit of art school experience, but it felt quite sort of raw and working class as well. Which I think.
Oh, they definitely are. I was going to mention your fanzine called Hex. I don't know where you got that name from.
Well, I'll tell you, the weird thing is that was called Hex before you did Hex. It wasn't really. We'd been doing something at school about the Pendle Witches and stuff like that, and the word Hex just really leapt out at me. So, I chose that. It never really did anything because I did one copy and then and I don't mean one issue, I mean one copy. And I couldn't, because I was still at school, and I couldn't afford to photocopy it. So it just sat on the shelf for ages.
I've read the transcript of your interview with Pete Hawk, and I don't think the world's missed out on the literary masterpiece there.
I think you could be right, yes. Yeah. So, no, there was a lot of ambition, but very little ability to follow through, actually, with the fanzine.
Moving away from the Fall just momentarily, I was going to mention another gig that you mentioned in your book, and I'm going to say if it was as bad as it's the reputation it's got now, the Joy Division at the Derby Hall.
Yeah, I mean,
that was a bizarre gig, wasn't it?
Yeah, were you there for that, Paul?
I wasn't there. No, I mean, I've seen the film. I've seen it in Control.
Yeah. What happened?
I think he'd attempted to kill himself either the night before or two nights before with an overdose. And for some reason, probably financial, they decided to go ahead with the gig anyway. And it was, I mean, I thought it was a brilliant gig, to be honest with you, right up until the riot. I thought it was amazing. And it was odd, but it was. So you had Section 25 were on. I think Mini Pops were on first. Section 25 were on, and then sort of before Section 25 left, some like the musicians in Joy Division came on and they started jamming a bit, and then Section 25 left. And then Alan Hempsel came on and sang a couple of songs. I mean, it's in Control, but in the film Control, which I do think is an excellent film, it's made to seem as if it's a spur of the moment thing. Oh, the audience are kicking off. Alan, come and sing a couple of songs. You know, well, it wasn't like that because I got this one of the set lists, and you can see it's indicated who's going to sing which songs.
Right.
So he sang a couple of songs. Then Ian Curtis came on and sang two songs, and then he went off. And then they did a jam of Sister Ray, and then everybody kicked off. There's some skinheads there who kicked off and started, you know, smashing windows and stuff. And then it was over. But the thing was, like, if that had been the end of the thing, they'd have done Sister Ray, and that was it. I would have just thought, what an amazing gig, you know, because there was like Simon Toppin, there was, you know, all the musicians from Joy Division, there was Section 25, you know, and it was just like this, you know, for want of a better phrase, a super group jamming, you know, and I thought it was fantastic, and then but not everybody thought that, so yeah, it was a weird one.
I mean, it is unbelievable that sort of the show must go on of that. I mean, he was in a bad way in a lot of ways. His health was nowhere, was it? And, you know, and mentally he wasn't in the best place in the world. The fact that they didn't just say, bollocks to this, we're going home, he needs to go to bed. Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable, isn't it?
I know.
That's the scene in the film where Alan Hempsel says to, where's my 25 quid? In my fuck-off pocket. Yeah. Rob Gretton. Yes. He's great. The guy who plays Rob Gretton in that film is just, it's so good.
He's fantastic.
I can't think of his name now. But then Paddy Considine played him in 24 Hour Pie People, and he's great as well. Yes. But they both sort of capture a different aspect of him, don't they?
Yeah, and weirdly, They're both Paddy Considine and the other guy who's called Toby something. I'm ashamed to say I can't remember his surname. They're in a film together as well where they're both brilliant, which is that Dead Man's Shoes. I don't know if you've seen that. Well, that's a fabulous.
I haven't seen it. No, right. I'll look it up for that.
It's a Shane Meadows one. It's fantastic, and they're both such great actors. But it's good. It's quite trippy and quite moving as well. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And if we're going to talk about nightmare gigs, and looking through your book, I've just found another one. And I think Steve's got a bit more of an opinion on this one. This is...
Oh, I know the one you're going to say.
I'm going to say Tuesday, the 8th of October, 1996, which I think you described in your book as the worst gig you ever did, Steve. Is that right?
I think it was up there. Definitely got up there, wasn't it? I'm surprised there was no riots that night.
So that was the fall in Worthing.
All the windows stayed intact that night.
You must have sensed early on, Steve, that gig in Worthing wasn't going to go well, surely.
That whole tour was not going well. That whole tour was... I don't know who thought that was a good idea. Basically, Mark had got sick of playing the rock clubs, you know.
Yeah.
Where you can, but I don't know if it's quite the same now, but then you could go on at 11 o'clock if you wanted, or nobody seemed to mind if they could drink. But them provincial theatre venues like that were so strict with everything.
Yeah.
With all the times and it was just impossible to get Mark to go along with it.
Yeah.
They'd be banging on the door at 9 o'clock that you're due on. So there was basically trouble every night, but that was the worst one, yeah.
Yeah.
Was that the Brixie's last gig or the first one after she'd gone?
It was she left in Motherwell.
Right.
As the song goes.
Then there was the South Shields one that never happened the night after. Then we went to Worthing.
Right, so was it all?
There's some things.
Then we went to Worthing.
That is bleak.
So was the whole tour them sort of?
The whole tour was all them theatres, yeah.
What was the gig? What was the next gig after that like?
The promoter cancelled the next one, which was going to be Folkestone, Leeds, Cliff Hall.
Right.
So that was because it was the same promoter for the whole tour, for the London gig.
Yeah.
So we ended up not doing the London gig, was the last gig. So then we ended up not doing any more till London, and then Brix came back for that.
Right. Right.
Just for the one gig.
Just for the one to sort of say farewell. Like, so, yeah.
That was Brixie's first tenure, was it?
No, it's his second.
Yeah. The second one, of course it was, Of course it was. I can't do my maths.
Second time, yeah.
Right, okay.
The shoelaces incident and all that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I seem to remember Mark where they collapsing, like, you know, two or three times. And yeah, and somebody tied his shoelace, which is a bit of a twat's thing to do.
Bit of a twat's trick, that, isn't it?
I mean, it was
one of them low stages. It was a low stage, so.
Yeah.
But you think as well.
The low stage all round, yeah.
You've got to think, though, if Mark had been a little bit less inebriated, he would have spotted somebody tying his shoelaces. It's not a matter of seconds, is it?
No. Well, he was famed for long laces, you know. That's what people don't realise about Mark. He always wore very long laces on his shoe.
I have heard some of the recording of that, and I don't know how he... But the music is all right.
Well, I always said that. I've watched it, and I'm not sure you've not watched it, Steve, or through your fingers, but that last gig of yours, the music's incredible, actually. Or that
Brownies.
Yeah,
some of the music
is really good.
Yes, yeah. I've seen that. Yeah, I think that's true, actually. It just sounds like a really fucking tight garage band, you know.
Nice. But if we could get Steve to shut his yap for a bit and moaning, then it would have been a really good gig. So the last one I was going to ask you about was a bit of a, just so we're not going in down a dark end alley. We saw them in Brighton at the Concord in 2002, which is a bit of a renaissance for them by then, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, because I had to admit, I'd after the Worthing gig, I sort of didn't bother for a while. I still bought the records, but I didn't know why. It just felt like a bit of too much of a roll of the dice somehow.
Did you get your money back for that Worthing?
I don't think so. I don't know. I don't think it occurred to me. I think I was in shock, to be honest with you, Steve. I didn't think it occurred to me.
Apparently, people were demanding refunds.
I suppose. So 2002, was it? I think.
I don't think that is fair.
You what?
I'm not so sure that is fair enough. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't have got your money back at a normal club, would you? Because there's a set amount of time you've got to play, I suppose, at some of those venues before it counts as a gig.
Yeah.
Mm. Whereas at a rock club, if you come on to do 10 minutes, you've not promised anybody anything else, have you?
That's very true, actually.
Has anybody who saw New Order in the early 80s, some of them, they were 20 minutes, weren't they?
20 minutes,
that's true. I went to see Einstein and Neubarton once, and they were...
Brought the house down.
Just banging a fire extinguisher for him.
for not long enough or too long.
They were a racket, weren't they, them? And don't send a night man.
Yeah.
A good dog, I think.
Yeah.
I think they've evolved so much from that, haven't they? So there's still an element of that in what they do, but it's
are they still going?
Yeah, I think so.
Blackstar Bargell's not with them anymore, is he? Or is he?
Yeah, he's back with them.
Is he?
Yeah, and he does some solo stuff and he collaborates with other people. Yeah.
Well, he's in the Bad Seeds, wasn't he, for a good while?
Yeah, he's.
I think. Was he?
He came out fresh as a daisy.
Yeah.
Right. He used to do Kylie's bit on the Wild Rose Live, as I recall.
Looks
of Argyll. Yeah. Not quite the same, but, you know.
Did he wear the outfit?
So, something else I was going to ask you. Oh, we didn't. You've not said much about Brighton yet.
About Brighton?
So, who was in the band then? Who would that have been? That would have been.
That was Spencer, Jim, and.
Eleanor
was just starting to be integrated, so she played. She didn't play it on all the tracks. She came on for like four or five songs, I think, across the set. Yeah, but it was great. It was a really good gig, and also they just had the music had just been used in that advert, you know, for the Vauxhall Corsa.
Mention that to Steve. Oh. Very touchy about that, Steve. Oh. It's a very sensitive subject, if you'll find the pun, that.
Sorry about that, Steve. I don't know where to go from here.
No. So why is it a touchy subject for you then, Steve? You have to explain. You played that, didn't you?
Well, I was in I was in the room and it was written.
Yeah.
And it was me, Mark, and Julia.
Yeah.
And I think from what I don't really know it that well, but I think the bass is quite a big part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Obviously I left the band and we did it for a Peel session before I left.
Yeah.
And are you credited on the Peel session? I can't remember.
I don't think so.
Well, I mean, Elton John's cleaning lady, she wants a credit on Candle in the Wind because she was in the room when it was written. So that's what counts, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's all bass, isn't it? I mean, I don't know what I think I've heard
it
the Peel version.
It wasn't much fun down here, put it that way, 2 years after leaving when you tweet on and that advert comes on.
No, yeah. I can imagine, yeah. And you've not been paid for it.
No.
Thousands of lambs. Sorry, bit of chesty cop there. Anyway, moving on. We've all moved on, haven't we?
We've let it go.
I think we made a lot of progress this week.
Yeah, very good. It was meant to be a therapy session.
It's inevitable. I'm trying to think why I mentioned that. Oh, the reason I mentioned that is because I think it had sort of excited a bit more interest from people that had maybe forgotten about the fall, if you know what I mean. So
yeah.
There was some younger people there and it was just really buzzing and it was a great gig. And Mark was doing quite a lot of stuff with like tape recorders and stuff at the beginning and yeah, it felt pretty special actually.
Yeah. I mean, because they did get great again, didn't they? I mean, because there was the dudes, weren't they, the American guys, but that last lineup were just phenomenal, I think. They were just, I mean, whatever you say about Mark and people, you know, people, but to get back to that, I think, where it was just a joy, wasn't it? Because we spoke to, Kieran, and you can just see how much he loved it and, you know, it was the atmosphere had changed, and I think everyone's expectations were managed better. I think by then, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think there was a bit of a shift round about the time that there was the documentary, The Wonderful Frightening World of Marky Smith, and that was the same year that the Peel Session box set came out, and I think that changed the way that Mark felt about what he was doing a little bit. I think on some level, and I think I doubt he would ever admit this or even allude to it, but I think on some level, I think after that, he probably felt he didn't have as much to prove, or he didn't have to prove it, so he could completely get on with what he was, you know, what was in his head and what he wanted to do. And I think he just relaxed. And that might sound like creative death or whatever, but somehow it just led to this. I think that those last six albums are a really impressive run of albums. If that was a band's first six albums, people would be going, wow, look, check this out, you know. And I think, I mean, I wrote about this in the book a little bit about how I think of it a little bit like the last two Beefheart albums with Virgin, where before that he sort of flirted with a little bit of commercialism and this and that. And then those last two albums are really raw and primal and just getting right to the heart of you know, this sort of mutant blues. And I think those last six full albums have got something in common with that. All the sort of flirtation with commerciality or sort of formal song structure is more or less gone. And it's just this really raw primal sound again. And I think people who sort of like took their eye off the ball towards the end or dismissed that latter period are really missing something quite special, to be honest with you.
Well, 100%.
It's a great position to get yourself in, isn't it? That where you can basically just do what you like and you've got an audience there who
because it's quite unusual, isn't it? That I can't struggling to think of. I suppose Bob Dylan would be one where he doesn't pander to his back catalogue necessarily. You can do it if he wants, but you don't go to, you know, you don't go to see Bob Dylan with the expectation of hearing him play like a Rolling Stone, like the record, do you? I suppose.
I don't I don't really like Bob Dylan.
I mean,
but yes, no, I know exactly what you mean. It's true.
It's not many, I don't think.
No, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because culture's sort of moved in the opposite direction a little bit now, where it's like, you know, bands getting together and playing classic albums in the sequence they were recorded. That's becomes like a big part of the, you know, a bit. Or bands doing a series of nights where they'll do a different album every night. That sort of rocker's heritage industry has really become a thing that it never used to be.
No, I think that Sparks did it, didn't they? Sparks did every album one night after the other.
That's right, yes, yeah.
That must have got a bit weird around the dog years, you know, around One Black Sucker or something. That must have been interesting, mustn't it? Yeah. Before the Renaissance.
Yeah, no, there's always dark albums with long-running bands, aren't there, where you think,
Well, we talked to Ed Blaney, he was saying, Mark got offers for that, a few offers.
Yes,
and he wasn't quite as averse to it as you might think. I mean, obviously, he never did it, so he must have been fairly averse to it because it never happened. But I would have thought he wouldn't have touched that with a 20-foot barge pole, would you?
No. I mean, I remember him saying to me at one point that there'd been a couple of offers to play Hex at something at the Barbican or something like that, you know, and he was very, very dismissive of it. But I think it's weird because it's still the Fall, but it's a completely different band. You know, it's a few different bands down the line, isn't it? So
of course, the
Kieran, Pete, and Dave and Eleanor lineup playing Hex. Yeah. Like, well, what would that be anyway? You know, it's like, I'm sure Mike was smart enough to think that wasn't gonna fly. You know,
no. I mean, like you say, it
wasn't gonna get the original band back together.
For one last job.
No, I can't say that happening either. But I don't think that would have worked. I don't think so. No, it would have been. Everyone would have been in too weird a place, I think, for that to work.
Yeah.
I think. Do you, Steve?
I can't believe that he'd even entertain it with the current band, or they would.
Oh no! He did that. Was it Blackburn where they did like a sort of greatest hits DVD?
Oh yeah, but that wasn't no. I mean, there was a few more sort of because that was the tour that you know, we were talking about seeing them in Brighton in 2002.
Yeah.
That's the same tour as that. So I think that tour did have a few more. Backwards looking songs on it. I suppose there was like. Stuff from this Savings Nation, Grave, and a few other things. So I don't know if it was exactly greatest hits, but it certainly had a few more from the vaults than you would expect.
But not that you could tell. I mean, you'd only have to change a few more. You wouldn't have known it was the classical.
No, very true. Well. And certainly, I know Eleanor played like keyboards and that. It was very atonal, very, you know, sort of slightly stomping over it in a way. But I like that. Why not? You know.
Yeah. Well, she only had that tiny little keyboard, didn't she? That was,
It's a Korg monophonic. But it had a really deep bassy sound, which I think was great. But, I mean, that's weird, you know, that her keyboard sound became one of the sort of defining sounds of like that last era, didn't it? In a way, that sort of burbling sort of noise. Really like that.
Right, there was something else I wanted to ask you about while we're still about. You got some mutual friends in our friends at Factory Icon, Malcolm and Claude. You worked there for a bit, didn't you?
I did. Well, yeah, my work implies that I got a wage, which I didn't.
Wasn't the highest in the world, was it?
That was really exciting. There's Brian Nicholson was the art technician at Blackburn College where I was studying. And we made a couple of videos together and like sort of arty things. And he sent them to the Hacienda. Just as the Hacienda had opened. And they said, oh, yeah, we'll show these. And, you know, you should come in and do, you know. And so before we knew it, we were sort of making promo videos for like Section 25 and The Wake and people like that. So, yeah, no, right. it was, you know, I mean, I was, I would have been 17, I think, 17, 18. You know, and suddenly you're in Tony Wilson's basement, you know, doing this stuff. And Bernard Sumner's popping round, and you know, and it was a real buzz, you know. But yeah. I tell you what was great actually. One of the great things for me personally about Tony is, you know, he'd have come back from some do where he'd been talking to Melvin Bragg or whatever, you know, and we'd be down there editing and he'd be chatting about stuff, and he'd say something, and very occasionally I'd chip in with a bit of something because I was a bit overawed with all these people. Yeah. But he let me feel like I was being heard, if you know what I mean. It's like he wouldn't talk over you or dismiss, you know, if you said something, he'd pick up on it and talk about it, you know. And yeah, for somebody who still largely felt like a kid, it was quite a pivotal time, actually. It was lovely. Really good.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you'll have been working at ICOM when we did Perverted by Language, then, were you? Was that,
Yes, I wasn't involved in that because I think Malcolm edited that, didn't he? Malcolm Whitehead.
You say edited.
He had some glue, he had some scissors.
he record and play on the video recorder, yeah, didn't he? A lot of Big Macs at the right time.
I tell you what, though, that looks better now than it did at the time, I think.
Completely and utterly, it's like you're talking about the theatricality of the Virgin Prunes. It couldn't be less theatrical if it tried, could it? It just doesn't even attempt to look like anything like the videos that were coming out. I mean, I don't think MTV were queuing up to play it.
No, you're not pulling up alongside Duran Duran there, right? To try.
It was quite a task, wasn't it, to fill that 6 minutes or whatever it is of Eat Yourself
Fit? It was. Well, I think Mark's storyboards for that, well, I think he had a storyboard for them all.
Right.
And what he hadn't done is timed how long it took. And I think he had about 2 minutes of ideas when we started shooting. Right. So then you get like, we'll put a few bits of this newspaper in, and I'll have someone holding up a piece of paper, and you know,
The band walking down the street again.
Walk back down again.
What are in those drinks that you're knocking back?
Drinks that we're knocking back: milk, flour, and food dye. They were absolutely disgusting. We'll have some coloured drinks. So you just get food dye and put it in water. And I don't know if you've ever put food dye in water. It just looks like slightly lighter water. It doesn't look to you. Stick some flour in it and a bit of milk. That'll make it look. Oh, we've got a drink.
That's horrible.
Yeah, but they are great. I know what you mean about them standing up. They just look completely and utterly bizarre now, though. But in a good way.
Yeah, they're not like anything else, and they're really in your face. You know, there's no holding back with any of it. It's really punchy. Yeah, no, it's should be out on Blu-ray. Should be.
Well, speaking of screenplays, So we need to talk about The Otherwise. Well, I say, what a segue! I tell you, I should be on television.
Smooth, that good.
So The Otherwise.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Do we throw this together? So how long did it take for you to write with Mark?
It sort of evolved over quite a long period, really, because I invited him in to play Jesus on a series I was doing on BBC Three called Ideal with Johnny Vegas.
I was watching that again today. It's great, isn't it?
Oh, cheers, man. Yeah, and it was a really good show to make. But yeah, so Mark came in and did that. And then afterwards I was talking to him, I said, have you ever thought about writing, you know, narrative stuff for television or whatever? And he was saying about he developed some stuff for some Welsh company, had that been lost? And I said, well, look, you know, if I can be of any help to you, you know, like pitching stuff, just let me know. And that was what I was thinking at the time, really, was just, you know, if he's got ideas for like ghost stories or whatever, you know, for TV, I'd love to help him realise that, you know. And then he phoned me up a couple of weeks later, maybe even a week later, and just said, oh, you know, do you want to meet up and we can talk about writing some stuff for television together, and I think it should be really scary. And that was it, really. And so we got together and we developed an idea for a bit like a Tales of the Unexpected or Outer Limits, Twilight Zone type thing, like an anthology thing, you know. And I just, you know, and we worked quite hard on it, but we didn't do scripts. We just like worked out little stories and stuff. And I sort of couldn't get anybody interested in it somehow. I was pitching it to different places. And to be honest with you, Mark's reputation preceded him, you know, that it was, you know, people were going, oh, well, I saw him on, you know, talking about John Peel and I'm not sure about him, you know. Yeah. I'm sure we want to work with this guy, you know. And I said, oh, it's just like there is so much more to him than that, you know. It's this like that. And I think, you know, and I said to a few people, I said, don't forget, John Peel would have been utterly delighted by that. You know, everybody being outraged on John Peel's behalf. And I think Peel himself would have loved it. You know, anyway, so we got knocked back, but we stayed in touch. And, you know, I was up in Manchester for like 3 months a year for 10 years, really. So I saw a lot of Mark when I was up there. And a few years later, we sort of had another go at pitching it and nobody was interested. And then we just, whenever we met up, we'd sort of talk about it, you know, and then I can't remember who suggested it, if it was him or me. We just said, well, maybe you should do it as a film script. And then once we started doing that, we'd probably been friends for about 6-7 years by that stage and talked a lot about the TV anthology ideas. So we just took two of the ideas from the anthology series and sort of stuck them together or blended them together for the film thing. And it probably took about, to do the script on and off, it probably took about 5 months, but that's with, you know, quite a lot of off time. Because we're both doing other stuff, but it was really quite balanced. I think there's two ways people tend to think about this project. Either I wrote it all and it was just, you know, Mark spouting a few weird ideas and me turning them into a script, or Mark came up with it all and I just typed it out, you know. And it's not either of those, really. It's down the middle. You know, he'd send me whole scenes that he'd worked out and I'd write scenes, and then we'd sort of chuck stuff in on each other's. You know, we'd write stuff independently, send it to each other, then meet up and go through it, you know. And so we didn't have many consecutive days, but, you know, across a couple of months, we'd meet up 3 or 4 times, I suppose, and spend a lot of time on the phone. And it was great because he was really into it. You know, he'd literally phone up in the middle of the night, you know, like 2 o'clock in the morning. And he's, and I'm answering the phone thinking, Christ, what's this going to be? You know, it's like, you know, hospital or something. And it's him going, I've just come back from Portugal. I had some really good ideas on the plane, you know. So have you got a pen and paper? You know, I'm sort of like wiping the sleep from my eyes going, I'll just get one. So, yeah, it took a while.
Is it filmable, you think?
I think it is filmable. I mean, we got knocked back. You know, we showed it a few production companies at the time, and again, Mark's reputation made people scared because he's not only behind the camera, the Fall and Marker characters within the thing as well. And I think people were quite worried about that. And loads of people just, this is too weird. We heard that a lot, you know. And I think it's not that weird. You know, it's got some weird things.
No, it's not.
It?
No,
but I think
that was the big thing that I thought. I thought this is going to be like, you know, when you get like the Monkees film Head, where you just think this is absolutely bonkers. But I was quite happy for it to be that bonkers. You know, I mean, you know, there's plenty of not bonkers TV out there, but it hung together in a way I wasn't expecting, really. Which is strange.
I mean, I think that's probably part of what I brought to it, I think, is that is structure. I'm really quite good on structure and you know, it's like we came up with a lot of odd ideas and sort of structured them. And I think it is satisfying. I think when you get to the end, you feel like you've followed the characters and you care about the characters. And I think, you know, we always said once if we can get this into production, we will make it a little bit weirder still. You know, we'll play around with the editing and, you know, whatever. But but yeah, I think it's a cogent horror film.
Yes,
I think.
Indeed.
Yeah, yeah.
Your big problem now is you're gonna have to get somebody to play Martha, aren't you? Now
I know. Well, I mean, that's one of the curious things is like now, you know, what, 3.5 years after Mark passed away, there is interest in it, and you know, there's been interest from a few different people. But Pollard and Forsyth, Ian Forsyth and Jane Pollard, who did, they're sort of that YBA generation, really, of like young British artists, but they do stuff exclusively with film and video. And all their stuff tends to be rooted in music and musical subcultures. They did things like they restaged the last Ziggy Stardust gig. And then they did that film, is it called 20,000 Nights on Earth? Nick Cave and Cardi Monet.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So they did that. So their stuff, it's sort of, it's arty, for want of a better phrase, but it sort of engages with, you know, mainstream as well. So they got in touch, they read it and they were really excited. So, yeah, with them, we're at the moment trying to sort of get it into production. Which, you know, fingers crossed. Thing is, it's like, you know, I've been at this game 20 odd years, and it's like what you learn is radio's slow, TV is very slow, and film is glacial. You know, it's just like, I've had film scripts, you know, that we're like 6 years down the line here from development. So I'm on one hand, I've had a few
conversations with people about my book as well.
Yes, but we need to talk about that. But yeah,
not on the air, please, gents. No, come on. No.
So yeah, I'm hoping we can do that. But yes,
casting
Mark is a tricky one. He's not the main character, as anybody's read the script will know. But he's one of the sort of, he's a chunky supporting character, shall we say. So
how old would he be in it?
Well, it was supposed to be contemporaneous to when we wrote it. So it was written in 2014, 2015. So it's Mark at the end of his life, I suppose, really. Yeah, so sort of late 50s.
Would it have to be him? I think it is fairly key that it is, you know, you could make it a generic singer in a band, I suppose, could you? But I don't think it'd work quite the same, would it?
Yeah, I think it's I think it's sort of so woven into the fabric of what the story is. And also there's some of Mark's personal experiences are in there as well. Where they go to score some speed, which was a story he told me but when he was young, that this guy, I think was some counsellor, had answered the door sort of bollock naked. But as nurse that it wasn't, and he said, "Oh yeah, come in, lads," and they've gone inside, they'd scored some weed and some speed, I think, and there was clearly about to be some sort of middle-aged swingers thing going on. I think this was when Mark was about 18, and they were trying to get Mark and Linda over to sort of join in this swingers scene. And I remember Mark saying, "No, once we scored, we couldn't fuck off quick enough." That wasn't going to happen.
I don't think that'd been quite his cup of tea. I don't think.
I don't think so.
No, but I mean, I do wish you all the best for that. That'd be great.
Oh, cheers, man. Wouldn't it? Well, would be really good.
Yeah. I think there's something about now the fall. And Mark, certainly Mark, he's got a kind of respect that I don't know. I can't see that it's coincidence that he's no longer with us, but they've definitely elevated, haven't they? I think.
Yes.
And people take them much more seriously and give the group much more credit than they got at the time, I think.
Yeah.
It's an old thing that you never appreciate it till you're gone, but. Without be funny, I don't think he helped himself sometimes, but it's great to see that people respect the fall in a way that it's a shame he didn't get to see it at that, but he'd probably hate it anyway, wouldn't he? To be honest,
well, I think he'd hate it, and I think he'd probably do his best to screw it up or screw some of it up, you know, just because that was hardwired into it, wasn't it? You know, it's like,
yes,
it's like as soon as you get within an inch of perfection, it's like, well, let's do something else instead, you know.
Did you ever find that, Steve?
What's it? What?
just when you think you're getting there, you will do something else instead. Happened to the fall a couple of times, didn't it?
Once or twice, yeah.
But then, you know, that's why the fall aren't any other band, isn't it, I suppose. So.
Yeah. I'm shocked that people still listen to this stuff 40 years later.
Dead right. Yeah, well, it's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think that it's one of those things where the fall are lots of different things to different people, aren't they? I mean, that's perhaps a bit of a trite thing to say, but it's
that's,
like...
It's true, because that's like that Excavate book is kind of that, isn't it? That's kind of saying you can write about the fall in the context of anything, can't you?
Yes, it's true. And I think, you know, and it's like, obviously there's people who, for them, certain eras are what really count, you know, and the rest they're not so bothered about. Or for some people, it's certain strands within it, isn't it? You know, I think it's interesting. You get a lot of bands that, or artists who describe themselves as being experimental, and yet they sort of got a signature sound. You can always tell it's them, you know. Yeah. And I think the thing with the Fall is that, you know, there is a lot of sort of cul-de-sacs, if you like, and stuff like that, you know, where you just think this doesn't, well, crew filth or something, where people go, what the hell is this, you know? But that's part of the mix, that's part of what's going on, that's why it's the fall.
That came up on something the other day, somebody put it, Noel's Chemical Effluent.
Yes.
I'm not on that. I thought I'm not on that, but I'm on it. Yeah, it's actually not that bad.
That's a great track. That I think that's a belter. Yeah, yeah.
Why that wasn't Noel's Chemical Effluent? I mean, it screams top 10 hit to me.
I can see him on the terraces. It's a real sing along, isn't it?
You can forget your Three Lions, mate. Noel's Chemical Effluent.
But it's very true though what you say. It's very true what you're saying is that there seems to be a level of sort of respect and regard now that is several notches above what was available to Mark when he was here. And it's, I think, because he's not here, is really gratifying. You know, I think if he was still, like you say, he would probably be making things worse. But no, it's good. It's well deserved. You know.
Yeah, really definitely. Well deserved. Yeah. I mean, evidently, just to have a band that lasted that long, that never became a heritage act in any way, is kind of astonishing, isn't it, really?
Yeah, well, the only comparable one is Wire, you know, in terms of a band that are always doing the next stuff that, you know,
they split up for 15 years or something.
Yes, exactly. But in terms of like of that generation, that seniority. Yeah.
And I don't like it that they don't do Outdoor Minor. They should.
I have a fly.
Well, it's been like the Fall. They will occasionally chuck something in that you are not expecting at all, you know, from the back catalogue. But yes, no, that's the difference, isn't it? That the Fall never stopped, and the Fall, above all else, were a live band, weren't they? You know, for all the albums and all the sessions, it's the live stuff that's the real sort of kernel. So now I think,
yeah, and it did turn into a kind of tour record cycle for a bit, but for a lot of the Fall's career, it was. They played live all the time, didn't they? I mean, it wasn't like, you know. I mean, it took a bit to get going after Christmas, I think. But it was a kind of integral part of the band. It wasn't we'll be touring next year, which you look at bands now and they seem to do so little compared to how bands worked back in. I mean, I know it sounds like an old git there, but it seems to be the model doesn't seem to be sustainable, does it? That you put that much product out and you do that many gigs, I don't think.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It definitely feels now like that people are sort of holding back a little bit. I don't know, but then I mean, one thing I wanted to ask you actually is like what the feeling of because I know both of you written about that notion of you'd sort of play something in the soundtrack, or come up with something in the soundtrack, and you're pretty much playing it that night. I mean, how does that affect your nerves? Did you just get on with it, or were you?
But I'm never nervous. I don't know why.
Really?
But I never got nervous.
Not in the traditional sort of way of nerves that you'd think would stop you doing something. Well, I don't know.
I mean, you're doing a song for the first. You've just played On This Day for 15 minutes. You know, they're not going to suddenly rebel when they hear one they don't know, because they don't know half of them anyway, do they? I suppose, but it was pretty rare that I think it was certainly when I was in the band. It only happened a couple of times where you'd play a song that was. I mean, Hit Priest is the one that sticks in my mind. But I mean, the reason that sticks in mind because it's documented, because it's on video. The first time we ever played it, because it was quite an unusual thing then to video gigs. I mean, it's not like now every gigs, but for some reason that gig at Leeds was videoed. And we're playing Hit Priest, and that was the day it was written. I mean, it's not all that, to be honest. It needed a bit of work, but all the work was done on stage.
Yeah, but it's the same song when you're watching that recording. Yeah. It's the same song, and a lot of what became the hallmarks of that song are already there as well, aren't they?
Which is incredible, really. Yeah, it's pretty amazing that. But I mean, but it was unusual. I mean, I'm not necessarily think it's a good idea. I think it's a bit indulgent in a way. Mm. But then, you know, hard luck in some ways. But I don't think you can do it very often. You wouldn't want to be doing four or five songs you'd written that day because you know, four of them would be shit, wouldn't they? Let's face it. But that was another thing with the Fall. There wasn't the same cachet on every song having to be, you know, there's another 15 songs around the corner, so if this one's not that, just wait a minute and you'll have another song coming along, which is great. There's a lot less pressure on. It's not that thing, we've got to write for the next album. That was never a thing for you, Steve, was it?
No. There was. We always seem to be working on stuff.
Yeah. So on something like
I'm trying to think of others. I think Deadbeat Descendant, we did it.
Really?
We played it the sound check.
And did it that night?
And did it that night, in America, in a festival in America.
Wow. What about what's it tonight? I'm going to rock you tonight. Did you do that? I didn't need a lot of work from. what's it called? That sorry.
Athlete cured.
Yeah. I mean, I'll
Hang
beep
on a minute. I'll beep it out.
The PRS will be after us, won't they?
I'm not admitting to anything here.
It's an homage. It's an homage. Right, well, I think we're rapidly running out of time here, Graham. That's been absolutely brilliant, haven't you?
There is something I did want to ask you about.
I did want something about. This has got nothing to do with anything, really. You've written for Big Finish for Doctor Who, haven't you?
I wrote one, yes. I wrote one for Paul McGann.
Right.
Yeah, called Faith Stealer, yeah. So, I was in Doctor Who briefly as
yes,
well.
I was coming to that, yes.
Oh, good, because I wanted to mention that.
I've been obsessed. You were picked on this episode, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Yeah, yeah, playing yeah. like a sort of robot waiter. Yeah, no, it was. No, that was definitely, you know, one to tick off the wish list.
Yeah, yeah. So, are you a big Whovian then?
I am more so the sort of 60s and 70s stuff. William Hartnell to Tom Baker. I'm sort of very, very keen on that. After that, I'm still quite keen. Not so much in the Sylvester McCoy and all that, but when it's come back, I think it's largely been a really, really good show. I've not enjoyed the Jodie Whittaker era.
I haven't really. I mean, I think she's really good as the Doctor, but
the stories aren't much, though, are they?
The stories aren't there, are they? No, for me.
No,
but
yeah, for me, it feels like it's gone. We could do, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there's been a lot of criticism, so maybe they'll have taken some of that on board. But if to me, the main thing is it feels like it's changed from a family show to a kids show.
Yes.
And
some of them were like the Magic Grandad, some of them early ones of that first series. Well, you know, where she goes back in time and meets Rosa Parks. And
I know.
Anyway, and we're digressing.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming along, Graham. It's been great to talk to you.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you. Thanks to both.
Take care. And I'll see you at the premiere of your TV, your film.
I'll be sitting next to you in the front row.
I can't invite, to be honest, but there you go. Okay, mate.
Right, cheers, man.
Take care. Bye-bye. That was great, that, Graham. Thank you very much.
Oh, cheers. Thank you. That was
really
that
really
flew,
enjoyed that.
Flew by as well. Jesus.
Thanks for joining us this week on Old Brother. Episodes are released every second Friday, so watch your episode 11 in 2 weeks. Please follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show, where you can find a link to Spotify and subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, give us a rating on iTunes or tell your friends about us. For further reading, The Otherwise is available from all good bookshops, and you can check out our books published by Root Publishers, and they're available from all good bookstores too. Hope to see you all again soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.